ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 22nd of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, nuclear investment. Australia will hand almost $5 billion to British industry over the next decade to build nuclear-powered submarines in Adelaide. What will that money buy us? And there's a cost of living crisis, but it seems we're still spending money on music. Sales of vinyl records are surging.
I definitely felt that I had to lean heavily on music during the pandemic. And I think that maybe a lot of other people experienced that too and realized just how important it was to have something that helps you to shift your mood or understand your own feelings and kind of move through them.
First today, school principals are calling for more support and policy intervention to help tackle the issue of violence in schools. It comes after a new report found principals are witnessing or experiencing the highest levels of violence, threats and bullying in more than a decade. Alison Shaw reports.
For 12 years, Denise Lofts has served as principal at a school in regional New South Wales. Over that time, she's seen increasing mental health challenges among students, parents and staff.
Some weekends I feel, you know, there's a real heaviness on us, and often I feel, you know, such a heavy heart watching my deputy principals deal with quite aggressive students or even sometimes aggressive parents.
An annual report from the Australian Catholic University revealed that nearly half of school principals surveyed had experienced or witnessed violence last year, a 77% increase from the first survey in 2011. More than half said that poor behaviour and increasing workloads were leaving them ready to quit the profession. Denise Loft says more support services in the school community would help.
There's a whole lot of things that could be done, and some are being done. I mean, just the resourcing of extra people, so counsellors, we have what's called a student support officer, which are phenomenal when you've got them working in a more proactive way as opposed to a reactive way. A student support officer runs programs like the RAGE program, so they work with students around anger. So we also have our police come into our school once a week. So it's proactive around respect, equipment and all of those sorts of resourcing, you know, they need to be addressed as well. So overcrowding. So you can imagine overcrowding creates problems.
Last year, in a bid to tackle poor behaviour, the New South Wales government updated its school behaviour policy, allowing principals to extend the lengths of suspensions without needing department approval. It's a policy that Denise Loft says has succeeded.
The fact that we can now suspend without notice has really actually started to make our playgrounds more safe, making our schools more safe. It's not about making things unaccessible, but it's also about making sure that we maintain a safe site.
States like South Australia have also recently introduced new policies, including banning aggressive parents from schools for longer. In Victoria, schools have been given the power to stop parents from entering school grounds or contacting staff. But not all agree on whether these measures are effective.
I don't like those policies. What happens is you're just punishing people who actually need more support.
Professor Anna Sullivan is an education expert from the University of South Australia and says the measures are making these challenges worse. She says what's needed is more health services for both staff and students.
Having good health care and other sort of service providers wrapped in and around schools to support them to do that work and the families would be really helpful. And that's going to require funding, and it's also going to require sort of rethinking the ways in which those supports are given at the moment.
Associate Professor Teresa Dickey is one of the lead investigators in the Australian Catholic University's report. She's calling for a national summit to coordinate strategies.
What we really want to see is one common table where everybody is talking to each other very transparently. We don't need a one-size-fits-all approach, but instead we need to look at differences between, so individual differences between schools, locations, states, student bodies, etc., to find solutions.
The federal government says it's working on solutions to the problem of school violence with the states, teacher unions and principals.
Alison Shaw. The Reserve Bank says more Australians are seeking help from community welfare organisations as the cost of living crisis escalates. The RBA has released its Financial Stability Review, which provides the central bank's view of the financial system and potential risks. Our business reporter David Taylor joins me now. David, the Reserve Bank has hiked interest rates, we all know, 13 times over the past 2 years. How does the bank say that borrowers and renters are faring?
Well, Rachel, in many senses, some not so well. Most mortgage borrowers have experienced an increase in their minimum scheduled payments of 30 to 60% since the first increase in the cash rate in May 2022. Now, here are the figures. Around 5% of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers are estimated to have expenses exceed their income as interest rates and prices have risen over recent years. So that's leading to an estimated cash flow shortfall. Now, information received through the RBA's liaison program indicates that more people than usual, and Rachel, that includes professionals, are seeking support from community organisations. And households with lower incomes, including many renters, have felt these budget pressures acutely. So what we're getting at here is for those on low incomes who are paying off a mortgage, their expenses are greater than their incomes. They're going backwards, Rach.
So does the RBA see that budget pressure as a broader threat to Australia's financial stability?
Well, the simple answer is no. The RBA says that despite pressures on household budgets, almost all borrowers have been able to continue to service their debts. That's crucial. Now, while housing and personal loan arrears have increased since late 2022, they remain, and this is important, below their pre-pandemic peak. So, based on their latest assessment of the economic outlook, banks expect arrears rates to increase a bit further from here, but rates remain low relative to history.
And despite the cost of living pressures, property prices continue to rise. What do the latest figures show us about dwelling values?
Well, again, this is sort of really extraordinary stuff. The Australian property market continues to climb at an impressive rate. Now, over the past 12 months, CoreLogic's Home Value Index, and CoreLogic is a property data firm, has risen 8.9%. This, according to the property data firm, has added the equivalent of approximately $63,000 to the national median dwelling value, which is around about $765,700. So if you owned a home based on the median dwelling value, you made, in inverted commas, $63,000 over the past 12 months. And it takes the index to a new all-time high in February. So the big picture here, Rach, is that property prices continue to rise. Those who are paying off those properties at the low end are really struggling, but on the whole are doing okay because they have buffers and some of them are eating into those buffers. And overall, the banks and the financial system are coping with it really well.
It's been a busy week at the Reserve Bank and for those who report on it, David Taylor, thank you.
Indeed.
The British defence giant BAE Systems have won the contract to help build Australia's nuclear-powered submarines. The announcement was made by some heavy political hitters in Adelaide. A former British Prime Minister and a Kennedy were among the delegation. In order to keep the AUKUS sub's timeline running smoothly, Australia will spend nearly $5 billion to help British submarine manufacturers. So what do we get for our investment? Angus Randall reports.
It's the next step in cementing Adelaide as the hub for Australia's nuclear submarine future. British defence manufacturer BAE Systems will build the AUKUS subs alongside Adelaide-based ASC.
These are big foundational decisions which demonstrate that the pathway to Australia acquiring a nuclear-powered submarine capability under the banner of AUKUS is happening.
Speaking at Osborne in Adelaide's northwest, Defence Minister Richard Marles says it's a significant day.
This shipyard, when it's up and running, will have 7,000 people building Australia's Navy.
He's been joined in Adelaide by the UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron, US Ambassador to Australia Caroline Kennedy, and Foreign Minister Penny Wong. It's an effort to show how interlinked the AUKUS construction process will be. UK's Defence Minister Grant Shapps says it's a remarkable opportunity.
The AUKUS, SSN AUKUS sub, not something that you would normally see done between three different friends, three different partners, a completely new approach to thinking about not just building a submarine, but our global security as well.
That relationship comes at a substantial cost for Australia. The federal government has announced today it will send $4.6 billion to the British nuclear subs industry over the next decade to design and expand production of nuclear reactors. It's ultimately a fraction of the estimated $368 billion cost of the AUKUS sub-program over the next three decades. The government says the British funding ensures the AUKUS timelines can be met. The Greens say it's propping up a failing UK submarine industry. Professor John Quiggin is an economist at the University of Queensland. He says it's hard to argue this money will strengthen defence manufacturing closer to home.
It's all been about creating jobs, economic benefits to Australia. And pretty clearly, if we're putting in $4.7 billion to build facilities in the UK, that pretty dramatically weakens that case.
Is this an investment? And if it's an investment, should we expect a return?
No, I think the return is we're paying a large amount of money in order to participate in a fairly small way in submarine warfare. We're putting a subsidy into the UK nuclear subs industry in order that we can have subs.
Professor Quiggin says the UK submarine industry could use the money.
The UK, of course, like most European countries, is trying to find all manner of weaponry to send to Ukraine. And even if that's wound up, the likelihood that Russia is going to continue to be a land-based military threat, that makes a nuclear submarine program look like something of a luxury.
Is there a risk that the US and UK keep asking for money?
I think it's a certainty. As long as we're willing to pay up, I think they certainly can use the money, and I think they're going to pursue their own needs, which can be assisted if we put in more money.
Former South Australian Senator and former submariner Rex Patrick is not surprised that BAE Systems and ASC have won the contract.
I'm very pleased that this announcement has been made, but we need to be very careful that we don't get too excited. This is an announcement that relates to a build of a submarine that is not even designed yet and will not commence in terms of construction until well into the next decade.
The AUKUS-class submarines are expected to enter service in the 2040s.
Angus Randall. On ABC Radio across Australia and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Candidates in Tasmania's state election are making their final pitches to voters in the countdown to Saturday's poll. It's looking increasingly unlikely that either major party will win enough seats to govern alone. That's adding to the uncertainty in what experts have labelled a very strange election. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Australia's last remaining Liberal government has been in power for 10 years. After calling an election a year early due to the defection of two backbenchers to the crossbench, Tasmania's Liberal Premier Jeremy Rockliffe is hoping he can pull off an unprecedented fourth term for his party.
We're just within a whisker of majority government tomorrow, 2024. We're the only party that can win majority.
Election analyst Kevin Bonham has aggregated voter polls from this year to try and assess what kind of parliament Tasmanians might deliver. While the Liberals look like winning more seats than Labor, no side seems close to securing the 18 seats needed to govern in majority.
As of last night, I had it at 15 Liberal, 10 Labor, 4 Green, 3 Lambie Network and 3 Independents.
And so in a parliament that might look like that, the Liberals would obviously have significantly more seats than Labor would. Does that mean the Liberals would be the ones to form the next government?
Well, it will be easier for the Liberals to form the next government in terms of having fewer crossbenchers to work with. But the issue here is that during the campaign, they have butted heads with just about everybody who they might have to work with. So it might not be so straightforward as it seems.
This election is unusual because Tasmania's House of Assembly is expanding from 25 MPs to 35. With 10 new seats up for grabs, independents and minor parties like the Greens and Jackie Lambie Network are optimistic of their chances.
What we are looking at, if the polls are anywhere near right, is a shared balance of power situation where multiple groups might be able to put the Liberals into power by themselves or put Labor into power acting together. This is a very strange Tasmanian election. We've never seen anything like this.
Tasmanian voters will choose 7 MPs to represent each of the state's 5 electorates under the state's multi-member system.
My guys have worked their butts off, and I think they've certainly earned at least 1 seat in every electorate.
Tasmanian Senator Jackie Lambie has fielded candidates in 4 of those electorates under her Jackie Lambie Network party. Her candidates haven't flagged which parties they'd work with to form government, but the senator has reservations about another Liberal term.
They've had 10 years to fix everything and we've got worse in Tasmania. That's what it comes down to. So once again, I don't know what the mix looks like. There could be independents up there. You know, we may get 2, we may get 4. It is up to them. But they've also, like I have, watched Jeremy Rockcliffe's behaviour over the last 4 to 6 weeks, and it's been atrocious.
The Greens could also be in a powerful position come Saturday night. Their leader is Rosalie Woodruff.
A really strong momentum for change across Tasmania, and that's our message at this election. Change is possible. It's been a mess the last 10 years under the Liberal government, and people are really struggling.
Labor leader Rebecca White is ruling out any formal deals with minor parties, but may still ask for their backing to form government.
We live in a democracy and I respect the will of the parliament. I'd be seeking the support of the parliament to endorse our plan so that we can start taking action on the cost of living. We can start building the houses Tasmanians need. We've got a terrible situation here.
Tasmania's next government will need to address a budget blowout and deal with increasing challenges in housing, healthcare and education.
Alexandra Humphreys. When it comes to religion in Australia, Christianity is in decline, but minority religions like Sikhism and Islam are growing. It's a shift which is helping to expand community spaces in regional Australia. Sophie Holder has the story.
Every Sunday night, the Sikh Gurdwara in Remmark in South Australia's Riverland region fills with the sounds of singing and chatting. It's a place of worship and culture for people to come together to pray and share food.
It's a very safe place here. You know, when you come here, you know that everyone here has the same intentions, that to sit together, to eat together, to pray together.
Minority religions such as Sikhism are actually growing in Australia, unlike other more established faiths. Australian census statistics show Christianity in Australia has been declining for decades, with over 1 million less people identifying as Christian from 2016 to 2021. But within the group of self-declared Christians, there's a growing number of people who broadly identify as Christian, but not with specific denominations like Anglican or Catholic. In South Australia's Mallee region, former Lutherans Dan and Helen Rooney are offering non-denominational services.
We figured that given that there are so many differences between the denominations, that we would bring it to where we saw the essentials and have everyone welcome into that.
Helen Rooney says they're trying to create an inclusive space for people in their small regional community.
I think people can feel like church, especially denominational church, is a little bit exclusive. And that's not just church, that can just happen. People gather into like groups. It's not a bad thing per se, but we really want to put the focus on everybody is welcome.
In the Riverland town of Barmra, attendance at the Uniting Church has dropped as it faces an ageing population and changing demographics.
In the past, the church was the centre of social life. Even in our youth, we didn't need anything else. It was the hub of community. Things have changed now and continue to change as society changes.
But worship leader Glenys Badger feels positive that people still want more, even if it isn't religion.
I'm not convinced that people are not religious, and I probably use the word spiritual. I talk a lot and I tend to talk to people when I'm walking by the lake or down having a coffee, and people are looking for meaning in life.
Timothy Stanley is a senior lecturer at the University of Newcastle, and he says some people are moving towards less rigid forms of religion and spirituality.
Not identifying yourself with Christianity doesn't mean that you don't believe in a soul or maybe an afterlife or even God. It's just that the identity affiliation with Christianity seems to be something that people want more flexibility about.
The growth in minority religions like Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Sikhism is seen as a reflection of Australia's changing demographics and immigration policies.
So people move. And globalization, as we call it, but just as a welcoming country like Australia is, we welcome people from all over the world.
Back in the Riverland town of Renmark, the Sikh congregation has grown, carving a space in regional South Australia for locals and people who have moved there.
The congregation is growing quite large, especially with a lot of new people coming from India moving in here and are coming to regional areas to get new jobs and stuff. So it just helps them to come here to face, it kind of reminds them back at home, and they've still got the core values and, yeah, it keeps everyone still connected as well.
The president of the Renmark Sikh Temple, Arjun Akun, ending that report from Sophie Holder. Australians are consuming more music than ever, and it's not just on streaming services. The Australian Recording Industry Association, or ARIA, has seen a new record of sales growth for the fifth consecutive year. But is the increase in dollars trickling down to artists? Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
4 2 months now I felt just Monique Clare is a singer-songwriter from Brisbane. Her consumption of music has changed in the last few years.
I definitely felt that I had to lean heavily on music during the pandemic, and I think that maybe a lot of other people experienced that too and realised just how important it was to have something that helps you to shift your mood or understand your own feelings and kind of move through them. So as someone who also listens to music as well as makes it myself, I felt that shift within myself.
Monique isn't alone. Despite a cost of living crisis, Australians are spending a record amount on music. The Australian Recording Industry Association says total sales for 2023 reached $676 million. That's almost 11% growth on the previous year. But artists like Monique Clare aren't necessarily seeing any bump in their earnings. She says her album has over 70,000 streams, but that only equated to $150, and it cost her $40 to put it on the streaming service in the first place.
On average per month, we're looking at about $12 from streaming services, which is pretty baffling considering it cost me about $25,000 to make this album. And I also pay about $13 per month for my own Apple Music subscription to listen to music. So I'm actually making less money from streaming services than I spend on streaming services.
But if someone purchases that music on a service like iTunes, it's a different story.
Suddenly my monthly income, like, you know, almost doubles. Like, that's the crazy thing. Just one person deciding to purchase an artist's music, it can actually, like, double your income.
Timothy Watkin is in a Brisbane-based band called Buttercats.
It's kind of pop, funk, a bit R&B, definitely like energetic, kind of upbeat, dancing music.
Despite having hundreds of thousands of streams on music streaming giant Spotify, that's not where the band makes money.
As artists, we're not actually, you know, receiving that much income from it unless you're, you know, Taylor Swift or Justin Bieber and you're seeing millions of monthly streams. But compared to something like, you know, going to a show and buying a shirt or a ticket, you're just never really going to see any kind of similar income stream.
Vinyl is another tangible option and represents 70% of physical format sales, equating to $42 million in 2023, which isn't surprising for Matt Huddy, one of the owners at Red Eye Records in Sydney's CBD.
That's exactly how it's gone for us. We had probably our biggest year on record last year, and Christmas was massive.
He says the numbers show the strong connection Australians have to music.
It triggers something, you know, when you put on a record.
Matt Huddy from Red Eye Records in Sydney, ending that report by Elizabeth Cramsey and Anna Pikett. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When one of China's most senior figures came to Australia this week, it was one unofficial meeting that really stuck out. Wang Yi was very keen to meet former Prime Minister Paul Keating. Today, Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts on what China's playing at. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.